On this episode of Roots, Race, and Culture, let's unpack the history behind the societal wealth gap in America.
For anyone facing social, cultural barriers to success, our history is not going to be our future.
And let's take a look at the first black-owned bank right here in Utah.
When you have a black-owned bank and you have a business owner come in, no matter what background they're in, they're trying to get to how do I make it happen? We're experts at how to make it happen because we've had to do it above all odds.
Join us for Roots, Race, and Culture.
Funding for Roots, Race, and Culture is provided in part by the Norman C. and Barbara L. Tanner Charitable Support Trust and by donations to PBS Utah from viewers like you. Thank you.
Hey, everyone, and welcome to Roots, Race, and Culture, where we bring you into candid conversations about shared cultural experiences. I'm Lonzo Liggins.
And I'm Dana Gerald. Thanks for joining us. The American dream is a deep-rooted belief that in our country, hard work and ingenuity is the pathway to success. When families and communities are actively building wealth, it's a prime indicator that the dream is coming true. But did the dream of black wealth die with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.? When he was assassinated, there were 140 black-owned banks in America. Today, there are only 20. And one of those banks, the first one in the Western U.S., recently opened right here in Utah.
And when we talk about black wealth, we're not just referencing dollars in a bank account. We're also talking about access, opportunity, and the ability to build a future. For generations in the U.S., black and brown communities have faced systems that have blocked that opportunity, from redlining and discriminatory lending to barriers in education, employment, and corporate leadership. The playing field has never been level.
But this conversation isn't just about the past. It's about what's happening right now in banking, in the workplace, in policy, and in communities to finally close that gap. Joining us today in the studio, we have two very special guests. First, please introduce yourself, Mr. Bell.
I'm Ashley Bell. I'm founder and chairman of Redemption Bank. Originally from Atlanta, Georgia, and have been excited about this journey we've had here in Utah, creating such an exceptional, historic opportunity, not just for black entrepreneurs, but really just a beacon of hope and a very unique platform for growth of economic activities around the region.
That sounds fantastic. And we also have Sui Lang. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you so much for the invitation to join you here today. Sui Lang Pinoke, founder of Rethink International, where we challenge people to rethink how and what they think by developing the concept of bridge building, going to the margins and working your way in. And as we'll talk more about today, I see banks as bridges in closing a lot of those economic gaps that exist across communities across our country.
Boy, there are a lot of bridges that need to be closed when it comes to that. Where are you originally from?
I think so. Originally from the beautiful islands of Hawaii, but raised here in Salt Lake City. Spent about 13 years of my career on Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. So I have three homes, areas that I consider home. But Utah's near and dear to my heart. It's where I've chosen to set up shop, me and my family. So I really look forward to, I'm also strong champion, supporter, and investor in Redemption Bank. And I think it will play a critical role in building bridges across the Beehive State.
So to kind of help our audience, I'd like to first just kind of establish some groundwork for what we're doing. What is the biggest misconception about the black wealth gap, the black and brown wealth gap that you guys feel, because both of you have spent time in Washington, D.C. and around the country?
You know, I think the first misconception, first of all, black banking at first, you got to go straight to the question of what is a black bank, right? Some people, if you've never heard of one, if you live somewhere where there aren't any, you may think like, well, it's a black bank, it's only for black people, so it's not my thing. That's absolutely not true. And that misconception is what is a big part of the reason that you saw a decline in black banks over the last 60 years. You saw a situation where black banks were only in black communities, and you saw exodus of black talent from those communities. And so every other bank became attractive. You saw black families move their money outside of the community, and that left those banks with just a very hardcore group of folks that live somewhere off Martin Luther King Jr. Drive.
Right.
For us, this is unique because this is the first time a black-owned bank has not been located in a black community anywhere in America. It's never happened. So it's a unique experiment. But for us, the question was always, could we create a bank that's just black owned, but open to everybody, and be a centerpiece of economic activity and a catalytic engine for growth?
And I think that's probably the misconception, is that people think that when you say black bank, you're thinking, oh, it's just for black people.
Right.
It's not for everyone. But a black bank, it's just a bank, correct?
Right. That's right. And that crosses over just businesses in general. There are a lot of businesses that the consumer is across the board, you know, identifies as multiple nationalities, ethnicities, races.
Yeah.
And many people may not know the ethnic identity of the owner,
mm-hmm.
right? And they find out, oh, that's a black-owned business, and it's wildly successful, mm-hmm. right? So this is just another example of that. And to Ashley's point, it's most important to also focus on the economic standing of the community in which these institutions are placed in.
Yeah.
And so Redemption is stepping into the playing field from a totally different posture from other minority banks,
mm-hmm.
Which, again, we're so excited to see the impact that standing can have.
Well, you know, being a part of the community is a big part of any financial institution, it seems. And we want to also kind of help people understand, historically, there's been a whole lot of suppression in these communities of color that has really contributed to part of this decline in black wealth in America. So, what are some of the things? We'll talk about some of the historical things. The first thing I can think of is the Trail of Tears, right? Like, we're talking hundreds of millions of acres of land taken from indigenous people in America, and then they were all put into these reservations. I remember the first time I drove from Utah to Texas, and I went through a reservation. I'd never seen a reservation before, and I understand why they call it the Trail of Tears. I almost cried at the sight when I realized what I was seeing. What are some other historical things that you guys think really contributed to the wealth gap?
Well, I think that you have to look at access to capital, right? Historically, you know, we're a country that is capitalist, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we've proven that mantra of capitalism should be a theme for anyone to make it anywhere, right?
Sure.
That is the theme.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But we still strive every day to be a more perfect union, because we haven't really proven that we've allowed capitalism to do what it should be doing. We've had impediments in capitalism.
Yeah.
You can't really say you're capitalist if at some point people had to work for free.
Right. Okay, right.
That's not capitalism, right?
Right.
If you have a system where women can't own property, that's not capitalism.
Yeah.
If I can't go eat at any lunch counter that I want, that's not capitalism. So we've had people get in the way of capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
And so now we're at this, hopefully, a new era of capitalism where anybody should be able to start a business, whether it's a bank or a barbershop or a bakery anywhere in the country, and that owner should be judged by the ability for them to deliver a product or a service, and they should be able to make as much money as possible. They should be able to go to the bank and get whatever their credit says they should.
Mm-hmm.
They should be able to own a home in any neighborhood if their credit and merit say so. We're getting there,
mm-hmm.
but to get there, you have to be intentional. And Redemption is a part of that intentionality.
So that begs the question. When in the intro it said we went from 140 banks, black-owned banks, you know, down to, I can't remember
20,
the number, I think it was like 20 or so black banks. Why did that number drop so significantly?
I want to plug a book, and Sue knows this book because I gave it to her, and it's a book called The Color of Money.
Mm-hmm.
The Color of Money is the history of black banks.
Mm-hmm.
The tie is it was written by a professor at BYU. So just throw that out there.
So that's right here in the Beehive State.
Exactly. The preeminent book on black banks is written by someone right here in Utah. Person that's not black.
Yeah.
So it just goes to show Utah is such an interesting place, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in that book, it'll chronicle and show you that decline primarily was because every time America catches economic cold, black people catch pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime people are fired, black people are the first to get fired when there's
mm-hmm.
a downturn, and the last to get hired back when the economy comes back.
Mm-hmm.
And so who feels that the most? The banks that hold those opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
The banks that hold the credit and the mortgages of those people who get hit the worst. So if you look and see when America hits the economic recession, you see black banks disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
And as black banks disappear, opportunity disappears with them.
and they're the last ones to get rebuilt.
This is accurate.
In addition to that, one thing I've learned in banking is risk, right? Learning how to mitigate risk and who's willing to take risks. Mm-hmm. And so generally, minority-owned banks are more willing to take risks on their own, members of their own community. Mm-hmm. That's a critical part of getting access to that capital that they need to start and grow their businesses.
And I think let's talk about that risk, because the risk is really just familiarity. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when you're sitting in a credit committee and you're trying to look at a credit, you're going to look at all the same things. Every bank's going to look at the same thing. But there is some human discretion in there. Mm-hmm. When you have people look and say, like, well, I recognize that last name. Mm-hmm. I may have gone to high school with that person's father. Mm-hmm. There's a little bit of credibility that was extended that's not on the paper mm-hmm. to that person because somebody knew them.
Yeah.
And when you see, oh, I know the address of that business. I drive by there all the time. Mm-hmm. That's a little bit of extended credibility that's not on the balance sheet.
The line outside the door.
Exactly, exactly.
Right.
So if you only function in certain communities, then you'll recognize that when you see it. So when you have different people from different backgrounds sitting on that credit committee mm-hmm. looking at these businesses, then you know you and I may know the same barber.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But someone else that doesn't look like us may not know that barber.
They not know that there's a line at the door.
Exactly. And so there's having different communities and cultures and diversity at the bank allows you to have a broader aperture for what you understand the community needs are mm-hmm. and what that sort of soft credit that you can extend to people because you understand the community, you understand the businesses.
That's fabulous. And, you know, I want to talk about businesses and communities because many times in America, black and brown people have built communities with strong businesses, yet for one reason or another, the system or even the other outside communities decided that they need to abolish that. We're talking about the Tulsa massacre, which is commonly known as Black Wall Street. I was there in Tulsa the same day on Juneteenth when Donald Trump was speaking a few years back, and it was really amazing to see how they were still, after all these years, trying to rebuild that community. For a long time, they also had this system, the urban renewal and highway displacement system. So this highway system that we have in America, the interstates, a lot of those were built right through the middle of bustling black communities where businesses were basically demolished and put aside to build a highway. So you have these other things in place, and without some sort of infrastructure financially to help rebuild, it seems like that's going to be a very difficult task for these communities. I want to get into a little bit more about y'all's personal experience. I'm from Texas, excuse me. I say y'all all the time. Every once in a while it slips out. Tell me about this vision that you had for this bank and bringing it here to Utah, which is unique. Tell me a little bit about your vision and the process.
Yeah, well, one of my co-founders obviously is Dr. Bernice A. King, who is the youngest daughter of Martin Luther King and Coretta Scott King. And, you know, her and I were on a journey looking for the best place to acquire a bank. We saw some of the challenges that our nation was facing. We saw that there needed to be a next generation of black-owned bank. Hmm. The ones that we have are phenomenal, and they do their job. They do the hard work that nobody's willing to do a lot of times. But they are sometimes prisoners of history, mm-hmm. meaning that they are locked in communities that have so many things going against them beyond the control of the bank, right?
Gotcha.
Some of the things we just talked about.
Yeah.
And when you think of what the future of black banking could be, one, you want to start a business somewhere where the law is on your side, regulatorily. Mm-hmm. Utah is to banking what Delaware is to corporations. You want to be here if you're a bank.
Wow.
This is why you have Goldman Sachs here. This is why Amex is here. This is why you could be at a community college in Wisconsin, but your student loan debt is here in Utah.
Explain that a little bit more for, you know.
So Utah is a home of these unique sort of banks called ILCs a lot of times, and these are industrial banks, right? And so it's a very unique concept. There's really only a couple of places, but Utah's done it best. An example would be, remember those Sears and Roebuck, right? You know, Sears would extend credit to you to purchase their products,
yeah.
right? Mm-hmm. So that credit comes from like a bank that they own. So those can only happen in a couple of places, and here's one of them, right? Mm, wow. So when you look at Ally Bank, you know, this is a spinoff of the old of a bank that used to be ILC. Mm-hmm. So it gave this sort of creativity to where if you're a student loan company, you want to be in a place like Utah. Mm-hmm. Utah really doesn't have a concept of usury, which is a concept that makes so extending credit to people, you have to be very careful about the interest rates. Utah's more of a like, you know, go ahead and do it. As long as it's, you know, fair to people, just go for it. Mm-hmm. That kind of freedom allows a lot of creativity, mm-hmm. which is why you see a lot of unsecured debt banks here. Mm-hmm. And that just brings capital.
And that's now, a good thing.
It can be.
But it can also be a bad thing.
It can be, right, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And I think from a business perspective, the market will dictate what you can charge people generally. Mm-hmm. But you also have predatory practices
that
you always have to be careful about, right?
Right.
So with freedom comes responsibility. Mm-hmm. And what I like about Utah is a state where they give businesses the freedom, and then you have to have that responsibility in how you take that freedom to the marketplace. And for us as a mission-driven institution, you love the freedom because you can get creative. Mm-hmm. But at the exact same time, we're going to make sure that our credit card that we have at Redemption Bank is the cheapest credit card in the market.
Right. Mm.
It's a 12% credit card. Doesn't move.
Wow.
If you got an Amex, you don't know how much they charge. It could be 16 to 28%. Love my friends at Amex. But that's every credit card.
Right.
It fluctuates depending on what's going on. Variable rate. We're keep it simple, 12% flat. Yeah. You know what you're getting. It's not going to jump. It's the cheapest in the business. So we take that freedom but also bring responsibility to the marketplace.
So that begs the question. You chose Utah. Utah was the place. You're somewhat from Utah. Why Holiday? Holiday is a unique place in Utah. Utah Holiday is specifically known to be a mostly LDS, mostly white community. Why Holiday?
So my family actually lives in Holiday. It's kind of my neighborhood where I grew up, and so it's done me well. Mm-hmm. One thing that's also important to note in this conversation about building capital, wealth building, financial capital, is the concept of social capital. Mm-hmm. And I believe that is truly what made the difference in Redemption, what makes the difference for Utah, in being the strongest economy in our country. The value system that we have here is based on faith, family, community, mm-hmm. and trust. Mm-hmm. You know, during my time at Zions, which is the oldest and largest financial institution in the Beehive State, celebrating 150 years a couple years ago. These are seasoned, proven, you know, successful bankers, you know, in the industry, not just locally, but nationally and internationally. And so to take the lessons learned from a historically proven institution like Zions, built upon, again, those same values, faith, family, community, a key part of their business strategy is community investment. Mm-hmm. And when you make that the forefront of your financial institution, it's the community that will keep you in business. Mm-hmm. It's those relationships that you build with those small businesses and individual clients. It's that social capital that you build in the communities that you serve.
And that
it's
that
very intentional business strategy.
Yeah, and that leads to growth. Mm-hmm. And so I really,
right.
I love
like the small little red state that not a lot of people know about, but we're doing big things economically and within this industry. And I believe that's why.
Well, this is fabulous. And I know that you also were at Zions and helped kind of bring this about. Let's talk a little bit about the community. What sort of community support have you guys found as you were searching for the place to build this institution?
Yeah, I think the first question you asked me, we came here for the regulations, mm-hmm. but we stayed for the people. Like it's you can't have a community bank without the community. Mm-hmm. It's just not possible. Yeah. So the question was, you know, could there be a black-owned bank in Utah? But if you ask any business owner of African-American, African descent in this state, can their business exist with just black people, they'll tell you no.
Right, right.
So you know that off the gate. So mm-hmm. the question is, can you build a business here with a broad amount of community support from across multiple groups, sectors, incomes? And I think we found, at least initially, a very open door from the investor class, mm-hmm. from the philanthropic world. The people who build foundations and institutions here in this state that are perpetually looking to make this state better, to look out for the least, the last, and the left behind, to pull up people from marginalized communities to the forefront of the capitalist experience. And that started with the Garth family for us. Mm-hmm. You know, Ken Garth Automotive, people know the name. Yeah. But Kathy Garth is a dear friend of Dr. King and the family, and she's become a dear friend of ours. Wow. Our son John and Melissa have been, you know, sort of like the epicenter of what kind of started this journey. And since then, once they opened the door, and that's how we meet Sui, that's how we meet, you know, Scott Anderson at Zion's. And it's a unique place because when you come here and you're like, okay, well, let's figure out who's sort of shepherding these sorts of initiatives, you end up at Zion's, you end up talking to Scott Anderson, you end up talking to Sui. And then from there, we were able to really find a lot of support from the Eccles family, mm-hmm. The Eccles family, who has been so generous to us in so many different ways. Hope and Randy Quarles, the Huntsmans have been phenomenal. Their foundation is one of our biggest investors. They lead in mental health, but they also recognize that an element of mental health is financial health. It has been documented that the anxiety that people in marginalized communities fear about what their credit score does to them, about when they look on your timeline and you see that a bank has been fined by the federal government for discriminating against women and minorities. You see it every 6 months. Mm-hmm. You just saw Navy Federal Credit get hit. You just seen a couple other banks I won't name get hit.
Yeah, yeah.
If that's on your timeline, mm-hmm. and you have to go in that bank and get a loan, how does that not cross your mind? Right. That I might not get a loan because I just saw that they're paying fines for not giving loans to people like me, even though I have every criteria that's necessary.
Yeah.
So the Huntsmans have been a big part of that. Gail Miller, phenomenal ally and supporter.
Oh, she's
you know, Gail has been, she was at our ribbon cutting. You don't get where we are now without people like Gail, who not only put their money where their heart is, mm-hmm. but who also aren't afraid to consistently speak up in those moments mm-hmm. of community distress. Like when their things bubble up, the question is who's going to step up and say the things that need to be said. Gail's always been there. Mm-hmm. And the Sorensons. You know, I would close it out with, you know, Jim Sorensen and the Sorensen Impact Fund. Mm-hmm. This is what they do. You know, this is at the ethos of why they created that fund. Jim has been a champion of program-related investments, which are a unique way to invest in companies that are mission-driven. Mm. He sort of really catapulted us in that space. So when you look at that group of people, and I hope I haven't left anybody, you know, I know I will, but that core group of families have been critical for us to really get an anchor in Utah.
It makes me wonder, with you talk about the hesitancy of black folks, you know, sort of investing in our own institutions. It reminds me of a story of Dr. Claude Anderson. He talked about how there was a gentleman he was talking to who was standing on a corner. There were two stores. There was one store that had that was a black-owned store. There was another that was a white-owned store, and they both were selling ice. And they both had the same blocks of ice, but the black dude went and bought it from the white dude. He said the white dude's got the better. The ice is just better. They just sell better ice. And so he was saying that there's this idea sometimes in our community that if it's white owned, it must be better. Do you run into that same hesitancy within our community, people saying, hey, you know, because it's a black owned bank, it might not have as good a resources, or it might not be as well to do as a white owned bank?
Okay, so I definitely recognize that sentiment because it is one that has been repeated a while. I challenge it at its core, mm-hmm. Fundamentally just because there is some trauma that African Americans have had with not being able to historically to even shop. I'm first generation after the movement, right? My mom and dad went to HBCUs not because they chose to, because they had to. They went to black businesses because they could not get fed at other places. Yeah. So there's an inherent historical trauma that sits with that, mm-hmm. that I won't hold anybody, you know, I get it. But what we're doing is intentionally the reverse and totally flips that on its head, right? Because we bought a bank that's been in the community for 40 years. Mm-hmm. That bank was run, you know, truth be told, was the only woman-run bank in this state when we bought it. Mm. Mm-hmm. The only woman-run bank in the state when we bought it. And of course, yes, it was people that didn't look like me.
Yeah.
So if you buy that bank, that company with ice, mm-hmm. it's already had that ice.
Yeah,
and then now we're here,
yeah.
and you bring in more money to that company that's got ice. And so now they got, I don't know if ice can get colder, but you make more of it, right? Right? So we challenge that because we just didn't show up. We bought an existing bank that was doing very well, that mm-hmm. was very well run. All we did was bring it more money, bring it better technology, kept everybody that was there primarily, and we have better services. So we know that that exists. And what I found here in our in this community, from the Black population especially, is an incredible amount of excitement. Mm-hmm. Because you got a lot of people that are born here, but you got a lot of people that moved here, who came from cities that had that sort of excitement around Black businesses, that loved to support each other, but really needed something to rally behind. The fact that we exist alone says so much about this place, to where Black people are like, you know what, I'm going to support. There's not a day that goes by that we don't see consistent people moving their business accounts, moving their personal accounts to us. But the reason is they know that this means more than just a bank.
But you understand that hesitancy as well. So.
Yeah, and I want to say everything about Redemption's story is unique, is historic, and is has already been so impactful, not just locally here in Utah, but across the country and around the world. When we started, you know, having conversations about the even idea of setting up shop in the Beehive State, I had friends from across the country wanting to set up accounts, and they had to wait, what, 2 years, was it? Before they could actually do so. You know, it was a long road to opening these doors, but it's also been a long time coming for individuals to finally feel like this is a win. You know, okay, we're actually making progress. We're moving in the right direction. Another thing I just wanted to note about the Beehive State is one thing I learned working closely with Scott Anderson at Zions is that key leaders within our community in the business sector, in the philanthropic circles, and also on Capitol Hill have conversations with each other. Utah's also number one in the country when it comes to social mobility. And going back to that social capital piece, right, that social mobility is key. You know, to feel like you can have access to a decision maker is everything, right? As someone who is just getting started and is already facing that self-doubt that so many of us who have faced the trauma of doors being slammed over and over again, you know, it's so frustrating. So to feel like you, there's some piece of hope that's keeping you going, and that's the fuel that gets you to the next day. Redemption just another beacon of hope.
And just to put a point, exclamation point on that, you know, I have a Black business owner text me this morning saying, I want to open up an account. That's Having a being a Black business and being able to text the person that runs the bank.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing.
And say, can I stop by?
Right.
Yeah, and I put him on text with another one of my staff and said, they'll meet you at the door. We don't get that. Yeah. And you get that at Redemption.
Yeah, yeah, you don't get that at Wells Fargo, I guarantee you that. So, you know, there's not just local support, but I know that this whole organization has been working behind the scenes for quite some time. This is a big, big undertaking. It takes years to make something like this happen. So we have some other investors who have spoken up and told us about their experience in supporting this. So let's take a look at some of these other investors.
Hi, I'm Brandon Comer, a truly proud investor in Redemption Bank. For me, this investment was an absolute no-brainer. I've had the pleasure of knowing Ashley Bell for over 20 years. Over the course of that time, I've watched him grow personally and professionally. I've also watched him walk in his purpose as he looks to deepen impact in communities, as well as find creative solutions to enhance access to capital and opportunity. We co-founded the National Black Bank Foundation and Fund together for the sole purpose of enhancing and strengthening the nation's Black-owned banks. We're very fortunate to pull them together and lend to some of the most significant names in sports and entertainment. For Ashley and Dr. King to then see a Black banking desert in the Rocky Mountain West, to found Redemption, to take a mission to not only enhance capital in that region and opportunity, but to create a blueprint for what can be done nationally was simply phenomenal. It's a good way to do good while doing well. And for that, I'm truly honored to be a part of the journey.
I love that, a good way to do good while doing well. We have another one, but I just want you to quickly just tell us a little bit about that relationship. 20 years is a long time. Could you just tell us a little bit about that relationship?
Yeah, you know, Brandon's a great investment banker, a great banking mind. You know, we got started out early. You know, I used to be an elected official in my hometown, Gainesville, Georgia. And I started out doing public finance, you know, and Brandon was a bond lawyer, a bond advisor. And when you're young and Black in finance, you learn really quickly, there are not a lot of people that look like you. And you're very fortunate when you find other people to be mentors. I would not even have been able to be a black bond attorney if the mayor of Selma, Alabama, Selma had his first black mayor, and he called me. He said, I heard you were looking to get your first deal. You want to come work for me? Wow. Until some, if that doesn't happen, you know, we don't really progress in the industry. So having a partner like Brandon, just where we can leverage each other and just work with each other to help build something special. And this journey brought us here. And what it's a reflection of is that we would not be here. And I'm gonna tell you, this is what my mentor, Sanford Bishop, who's a member of Congress to this day, told me this. When you see people like Brandon and I, and I'm from the South too, so you're gonna get a country anecdote right now. It's like looking at a turtle on a fence post. He didn't get there by himself. Somebody put him up there.
I love that.
and the people who have helped us along the way has helped us sit on this post.
That's amazing. Man, that's some country. What?
Right, I know.
Shoot, man. Drop that knowledge. Drop that knowledge. Okay, so we have another investor here. Let's talk. Let's take a look at this here.
Hi, I'm Dr. Jatali Bellington, a neuropsychologist and angel investor who focuses on mental and financial health. See, as a lifelong believer in building wealth for purpose, the opportunity of becoming a founding member of Redemption Bank went beyond just writing a check for me, but it became a movement and a purpose where I wanted to ensure that I brought forward not just other like-minded individuals, but entrepreneurs who could see what they were building. This to me was a financial institution that was going beyond just impactful infrastructure, but they were also reimagining to me what it can look like to build wealth. Also, restructuring access and ensuring that we could fund innovators and create generational wealth for people like my son and other future leaders. So happy to be a part of the success that is now blossoming as Redemption Bank.
What do you think?
I think the most important point that Dr. J brought up is her son. Mm-hmm. Right, we're building legacy here. We're building generational wealth. And literally, my best friend, Lorenzo Alexander out of Phoenix, Arizona, literally reached out to me wanting to know how they could set up accounts for their children. Mm-hmm. So we're not just trying to invest and build businesses right now in our generation, but we're setting up shop for future generations to prosper in ways that we didn't get to.
Yeah, and you've been doing this for, what, you said 20 years, right? You've been looking for people who, you seem to find these patterns in people who are entrepreneurs, who seem to be leaders. What is it that you look for a person that's like an entrepreneur or a person that you think is gonna succeed in something like this?
Oh my gosh, drive, ambition, hope. You know, the understanding that something bigger than you mm-hmm. is what drives you. And then going back to the impact piece, you know, how can we help? Identifying, I was always taught by my mentors, and we'll talk about mentorship a little bit more, but here yeah. I'm a proud alumni of the University of Utah, Hinckley Institute, studied political science here, Dan Jones, Tim Chambliss, those are two of my key mentors. But I was always taught to not necessarily prepare myself to get a job, but to do an external scan in the community in which I live in, and identify where are the gaps, what are the problems that we need to solve, and carving out some sort of career centered on doing just that. And I would encourage anyone that, you know, banking, financial services, that is one of those career paths that can do just that.
I want to present this to both of you, but specifically through the lens of women. Okay, women of color, they face some overlapping financial obstacles. So what do you think needs to change to allow their income to actually translate to this generational wealth? How can we bridge that gap, specifically for women and other marginalized people?
That's a great question. I want to go to the data. Yes. Because data plays a key role in all of this, and still, women of color sit at the bottom of the socioeconomic structures of this country. Mm-hmm. So starting there, I want to say what I have seen success in, first and foremost, is confidence and belief that our history is not going to be our future,
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And for anyone who has sat in those positions or places of which you have felt as if you were facing social, cultural barriers to mm-hmm. success, you know what it feels like treated unfairly
yeah.
or like something's not right here,
yeah.
right? One thing that I've seen a win come out of those individuals is that once they are sitting in positions of power and influence, they don't forget about those others behind them. Everything that they do is, how can I help serve others so that they don't have to face the same barriers that I did? How can I make the path easier, remove roadblocks and barriers for future generations? And so that's what I look for. Mm-hmm. And not just what I look for, but what I've seen made the difference in being successful.
The sponsorship and mentorship, which seems to be a theme from what I'm understanding, that how we can help bridge this gap is by supporting others to get to the next level, but then also reaching back behind and pulling people up with you.
That's where Black banks come in, though, right? I mean, Black banks seem to be a centerpiece to making a lot of stuff happen within our community. Because we're not talking about Black hospitals, Black, you know, grocery stores, Black Walmarts. The important discussion here is Black banks. Why is it that Black banks seem to play such a critical role in making things improved in our community?
You know, I think that, you know, being Black in America, historically, you've had, if you're successful, you've had to learn how to do more with less.
Mm-hmm.
You've had to be creative.
Yep.
You've had to overcome. You had to withstand. You had to be resilient. And so when you do find a way of being successful and being Black in America, you have a unique skill set that not only is helpful to your own people, but can be helpful to other people. So it's actually a superpower almost, right?
Yeah.
So when you have a Black-owned bank and you have a business owner come in, no matter what background they're in, and they're trying to get to yes, they're trying to get to how do I make it happen, we're experts at how to make it happen because we've had to do it above all odds at all times, right?
Amen.
So you got to take what's been a detriment and make it a positive that you can serve people and think outside the box because we've had to do it more than anybody.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, no other option but to get creative.
Yeah. And creativity runs in our communities, right?
What's that?
Creativity runs in our communities.
Creativity, innovation. I mean, that's what every corporate culture claims to embody. But, I mean, we've done it. We naturally do it because that's how we've always had to do it. And I would just add that, you know, our standards for excellence are extremely high and above and beyond any other basic standard. So we have to be twice as smart, work twice as hard. All of the things have twice the capital, you know, to back us, you know, in case something happens. And so we're continuously reinventing, recreating, restructuring, but somehow we always find a way. I mean, that gives me hope.
That's good. Mm. So now, one of the sort of foundational ways for building wealth in America has been home ownership. And there's this concept of appraisal bias and also lack of being able to get an equal mortgage as to someone else and these sort of things. How does Redemption Bank, which is Black Banking 2.0, I heard you say that before, how does it help solve some of those problems? Because I know you got a lot of history and understanding of this.
Yeah, you know, it goes back to what we said. When you talk about appraisal discrimination, that's human bias. You know, the numbers on appraisals in Congress and the government has tried to lean in here. It happens because this is human error. These are humans, unfortunately, not being good humans, right? As people, you see the stories every year. Someone goes into someone's house. It could be an immigrant family. And the guy walks in, doesn't look like that family, might not like the smell of the cooking, or he might like it and be jealous it's not on his plate, right? And he's like, this house is way bigger than mine.
Right, right.
I don't like it.
Yeah.
And that sort of unfairness, that the biggest point of discrimination in our system, whether it is banking or our criminal justice system, is this word called discretion. Discretion is the power that you have to, at your discretion, deem someone worthy of an opportunity or not, value of something higher or lower. If you have that power, then in that power, you will bring certain prejudices or not. So what I love about what Redemption's been able to do is that even the people who work for us or the people who want to be a part of our ecosystem, they've subscribed to a higher level of integrity. They've subscribed to working for people that might not look like them, who they've subscribed to read a book that they might not normally read so they can understand the history and the legacy of discrimination in the past. So they may be Black, white, or otherwise working for us. They've signed up to bring to the table a mindset that I have to look at people for more than their credit score, more than just their background or where they went to school or where they grew up, and see them holistically, because I know the system has not. And this is a place where we can get them that redemptive help of bringing those resources back to communities that historically have not had it.
Can I add something?
Yes.
Going back to your original stat, how we had about 120 black-owned banks in the country, now we have about 20. Mm-hmm. The big kind of game changer that I see in this whole redemption concept is you see a group of black investors acquiring a white-owned bank and converting it into an MDI, minority depository institution. That has never been done in this country before. And what that says to me is there is value in being black owned.
Yeah.
So I'm gonna let you sit with that for a moment. That is not a small thing. And that is huge. That is how the tides are turning. The game is changing, and there are new players at the table.
And it speaks to Utah specifically, because the reason that it's never happened before, let's be honest, the reason that no one's done what we've done is, and you and I being from the South, you can, I'm gonna just say this, is what it is. If we tried to do this in Mississippi, and you take a Mississippi community bank somewhere outside of Tupelo, and you said African Americans are about to buy this bank, you can imagine that we might not get the response that six of the 15 wealthiest families showed up and said, we're in. You won't get the response that local church leaders and business owners that are LDS and are not show up and say, we're in. You don't get that response. So not only did we were able to purchase the bank in a unique fashion, who showed up and said, we're here to support, is an extraordinarily Utah story.
Well, President Nelson, you mentioned, and he's, you know, rest in peace, rest in power. He was a supporter.
Yeah, I mean, you don't, again, you don't get one-on-one meetings with people of that stature like President Nelson because you have an idea. I mean, this was not when the bank was formed. We had just gotten going. But to be received by someone of that stature, to be received by Governor Cox, who gets on a Zoom with you and says, I heard you want to come to Utah. Let me tell you why Utah is the best state for you to be here.
Wow.
You don't get that in a lot of other places. You don't get that anywhere. So when you talk about why this is the place, I would argue that we couldn't have done this anywhere else but Utah. I would argue that if you're looking to start a black-owned business of any sort, and you're looking at competing in a marketplace where if you have good ideas and you have the right people behind you that can bring expertise, you get a fair shot here to do it anywhere else.
I wanted to say, look, I'm from Utah. Sweet's from Utah. Some of the bigger banks here, like you were talking about, Zions Bank, America First, the credit unions, those are the people that are, you know, the big players in the game. What would make people want to invest who are local into Redemption Bank, you know? Color, despite color. I know you have the mission, I know you have the right. interest rate, so, but like, tell me, as a local, you know, who's hearing about your bank, mostly from secondhand reading, hey, man, this is why you should come and invest in Redemption Bank. I'd love to hear from both of you.
Yeah, so.
Especially
so,
you, since you're a local.
So our investor pool and our deposit base, hyper-local to Utah in one aspect. So you do see a lot of the names I mentioned. All those people live not only in Utah, but most of them live in Holiday. Like, literally, you talk about the Garves, so you talk about the Huntsmans. The Huntsmans, you know, I raise capital locally at their kitchen table. Like, literally, I'm sitting in, you know, with Christina and Rick Durham, and we're sitting at their kitchen table, and people are coming in from the community saying, tell us about this bank. And to be able to have that audience, there's no other bank that's raising capital at people's kitchen tables that are 1 mile from the teller. So it's a hyper-local story in that regard. But at the same time, you have black business owners from Chicago to New York, from D.C. to Miami saying, I see the growth potential. So when you talk about from a just a X's and O's standpoint, from an investor standpoint, you take a bank that is small with a huge upside. Investing, you always want to get in cheap, get out high, right? So they see, okay, you're in the best state to do banking, period, in the country. Check that box. You bring to the table capital to a bank and big names that can help grow a bank. When you talk about the big local names, you also have Dr. King, you have all these athletes that are around us. The goal for us is eventually publicly traded. The goal for us is to have a national conversation to be able to say 5-6 years from now, we can answer a question that we cannot answer now. The question that we cannot answer now is, give me the 3 letters of the ticker of a black-founded company on Wall Street.
Right.
Wow.
Okay, can't answer it. So we will be able to answer that question in 4 to 5 years. Yeah. When you see the redemption ticker on the New York Stock Exchange or NASDAQ, you'll be able to say that that is a bank that tells a story of how we overcame. That is a bank that tells a story of what happens when black people from around the country, LDS members from Utah, people from all creeds and races came together mm-hmm. to try to do something different. But they did the two things that Brandon mentioned. They wanted to do good and they wanted to do well. Mm-hmm. They wanted to do good to make sure that people had access to capital, because capital and credit is like water. Where it flows, opportunity grows. Where it does not flow, you see banking deserts. You see title loans. You see predatory lending. Mm, so we make that capital flow.
You see 2008.
You see 2008.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So you get the capital to flow there, but you also see an exit. You see that when this is publicly traded, I see an opportunity to create value and make money for my family and generational wealth. So we start here, but we'll end on Wall Street.
But you also, but I'm talking about like even just John Q. Yeah. guy that works over at Smith's, who's banking with America First. Tell me why should he switch over to Redemption Bank instead of being?
So I would just say naturally, the purpose-driven, you know, the mission behind Redemption is a huge draw. Mm-hmm. But also, you want to bank with an institution whose products and services are the best on the market. Mm-hmm. Those two are not mutually exclusive. Mm-hmm. So again, as we mentioned earlier, we're dispelling all those myths about minority-owned businesses, right? Mm-hmm. They can also offer the best product and service. Mm-hmm. And Ashley will speak to this much more eloquently than me, but there's that concept of credit mm-hmm. that comes into play. And I like to say, when it comes to Utah's policy agenda, it's housing, housing, and housing. Mm-hmm. Right? Mm-hmm. And one of the biggest barriers to people of color owning their homes is credit. And so what Ready Life is doing is creating a path for individuals to be approved for mortgages based on rental history instead of their credit, because it just takes one flaw on your credit to knock you off the table and getting approved, right? That also goes back to that building social capital, right? If I've known Ashley for 20 years and he's been on time, you know, payments for 20 years, I'm gonna trust that if he could pay his rent, he could pay his mortgage too, right. But why not open up the door for him to build equity over time as well? That's the difference. So it's a game changer. And to your point, the credit card. I mean, I know exactly what I pay on my American Express. Yeah. It's a lot more than 12%. anyways, the best products and services is probably the number one way to bank with Redemption.
An additional add-on to that, and Sue said it, great job, Sue. She's learned the commercial. Our target audience are entrepreneurs for the most part. Mm. Like, we're going after people who are taking a risk on themselves. Mm-hmm. Because really how you change this country is through entrepreneurism. Like, you have to find a way of getting capital to the people who have the best ideas, mm-hmm. who want to take a risk on themselves and create jobs, right? Yeah. So to do that, the most efficient way to do that in our country is through Small Business Administration, SBA lending. Mm-hmm. It is the most tried and true proven way to do it. Yeah. We're the only minority bank in America that has an in-house SBA lending team, which mm-hmm. means we don't have to send you outside to a third party or connect you with a vendor. Right. We do it all inside. I ran the Small Business Administration for the Southeast United States, guaranteed over $6 billion of loans every year.
Wow.
And I regulated banks that did it. I know how to do it well. Mm-hmm. We started this bank to be the first to be able to do that and to be able to get you in a position where we can get to yes. Mm-hmm. Because when you can partner with the government and make sure that they're guaranteeing 75% of the loan, I got more creativity I can bring to the table. Yeah, the problem has been that the people who should be getting these loans have not historically gotten them. Mm-hmm. Only 4% of African Americans or minorities as a whole have gotten SBA lending nationwide.
And that's what's going to create the boom for the black community.
Is going to be
the entrepreneurial.
But the reason they don't do it is because previously they felt like the paperwork was too onerous. Mm. It was. I felt like they were nitpicking me. I'd just rather go on the internet and Google. I need money and see what happens. Right.
Right. Right.
And there'll be people out there. The new title pawn, the new predatory lender, is no longer next to the liquor store in your neighborhood. It's at the other end of a Google search. Mm-hmm. Because once you type in that you're looking for capital, what does that algorithm assume? That you don't know me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't know the guy at the bank who can get you access to cheaper capital. Mm. So I'm going to take advantage of you and give you a 27% interest loan that you will never be able to pay off because it keeps compounding every month.
So we have to create those relationships. We have direct lines to the people who can get you the solutions.
I want to just, before we close, this is fantastic. This is really amazing. Before we close, I want to just shift gears briefly to the political arena, because both of you sounds like have a lot of political experience. What about your experience in politics has helped inform and give you the mindset that you need to know what to do in this situation to help build black wealth, to close the gap? Just give me some experience. You have an organization that you run for women. Tell us a little bit about that.
I would say I run it. I'm on the board of an organization called Utah Women Run. I currently serve as the vice chair. Becky Edwards is our chair this year. It's now a program of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, so I'm proud alumni, again, that institution. And what we do is recruit and train women to run for public office. Currently in the state, 50% of Utahns identify as female, yet we represent 29% of the seats in our state legislature. We currently have one woman serving in Congress out of the six of our congressional seats. And so we're still below the national average, but we're making progress. And that's really what I want to focus on, is the progress that we are making. There are also some states in our nation that have reached parity, gender parity, and in fact have even a majority of female representatives in their state legislatures. But I also want to note, when I started off my career in the political arena, my goal was to diversify political leadership and democratize the media landscape. So what we're doing here today, and what I hope we continue to do, is represent the communities that have historically been underrepresented, right? Telling their stories, giving them a voice, and being informed, right? Our experiences and our perspectives inform policy, right? Correct. Those are the people we want serving in these policy-making governing bodies. And so across the board, whether it's on a nonprofit, in a private sector, corporation, or on Capitol Hill here in Utah, or back in Washington, our nation's capital. So that's part of the goal here, too.
We hear so much in our country when we hear, especially about the black community, is the, you know, what improvements that we need to make and what things that we need to do in order to improve our communities. These are the types of things that we do to improve our communities. The banking, getting involved in the political machinery. The political machinery can be tricky, but it needs to be gotten into, because we have to be able to be in those positions in order to make the changes that we want to see within our communities. And I applaud both of you for being involved with the banking aspect of it, because that's one of the biggest parts in our community that needs to be improved, because entrepreneurship creates jobs. It creates new minds that can come out there and say, hey, look, here we've got some new products, we've got some new things, we've got some new opportunities within our communities, and they don't just confine us to the three things that a lot of us see in our community, which is entertainment, sports, and social media, YouTube stuff. So, I don't know. What are your thoughts about the politics and about the banking? We'll let you have the final word.
Yeah, what's the biggest idea you want people to leave with from this conversation today?
I would hope that after hearing our story, that the people who are from here have a greater sense of pride about this place. That when I get asked the question, why Utah, everywhere I go, when I'm not here, why did you end up in Salt Lake City? I hope that they watch this program and they understand that this place is different. There's a lot of opportunity here if you're willing to seize it. And I fundamentally think that, you know, when it comes to our community, the black community in particular, that I hope they listen today and see that our best days are ahead of us. Opportunity is growing. And if you're willing to take a risk on yourself, then there's people who will meet you halfway. And there's no greater act of self-determination than to start your own business, chase your own dreams. And I understand that there's been historic barriers to doing that. But I hope that this conversation today, you understand that you have people here locally that are helping you, that can help you break those barriers down, that can help you think about the best way to not only create wealth, but to pass down wealth.
Yes.
Far too many of us are watching this today, and they may have a small business, but they may just be owning a job. They may just have a business that's paying their bills, that's getting them to that one vacation, that's paying them the tuition. Let's take that next step to not owning a job, but owning a business. Mm-hmm. Own something that you can pass down. Because I can't pass a job down to my son, yes. my daughter.
Right, right, right.
But I can pass a business down.
Yes, sir.
So let's elevate the level of standard we have for each other. Mm-hmm. Let's elevate the level of access we have for each other. And in that, mm-hmm. when we work together, we'll find a way to make sure that when we tell this story 10 years from now, that we'll see Redemption publicly traded. We'll talk about all the millionaires we made and all the fun we had with our friends in the process.
I love that. I love that. Amen. I know my daughter said she said it's the we're now in the digital Wild West, and I'm like there's a lot of truth to that because there's a lot of people out there that you know you could just absolutely gun you down, but you guys are in a position where you can actually do some change and do some wonderful work. So we appreciate having you both on the show so much. So
thank you.
Yes, thank you. It's clear that this is about more than just money in the bank. This is about opportunity. This is about options. This is about access. And this is about building something that goes on and on for generations to come.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't say, if you went on your Google store or Apple store, you can download Redemption Bank on your phone yes. right now.
Go for yes. it.
Go and ahead. Open an account if you so choose.
Yes. Matter of fact, before we even end this out, tell us where can we hear more about what you're doing and where can we hear more about what you're doing?
I'm on LinkedIn. Because I'm old. It's the only platform I know how to work. So
well, tell us,
find me there.
Where can we hear more about the organizations that you're working with?
LinkedIn.
Women okay, run. Just
but Utah just Women Run. We are now a program of the Hinckley Institute of Politics, mm-hmm. So you can find more about our information, get us and get involved there.
Okay,
and it's all digital, like you said. You can still come to the bank and come see us. I'd love to see you. Mm-hmm. But if you just are watching right now, you can literally go on your phone, Apple Store or Android Store, and type in Redemption Bank and open an account, which is honestly something you couldn't do until we bought the bank. Mm-hmm. So just think about it. You took a bank that was doing fine, it didn't need an online bank. Yeah. But for your daughter and mine and all of us, yeah. they're never walking in a bank if they don't have to. The kids these days won't even know what it's like to go through the front door of a bank. Their phone is their bank.
Yeah.
And so we have increased the technology. You can open an account, but the biggest thing, you can follow us on social media at Redemption Bank. And we have a promotion that is going on that you'll see from time to time. So whenever this airs, people can see it. We're always looking for people to tell us who they're banking on. Think about that. If you're an entrepreneur mm-hmm. and you go to our social media page and you leave a post saying, you know what? This is who I'm banking on to be successful. This is who I'm putting my money behind. We're willing to put $1,000 in your bank account and an opportunity to help you chase that dream. So we're not only just opening accounts, we're funding accounts too.
This is amazing. All right.
That.
Well,
that's wonderful.
From all of us at PBS Utah, thank you for joining the conversation. You're not going to hear anything like this anywhere else. And as always, other episodes can be found on our website, pbsutah.org/roots, or on the PBS Utah YouTube channel.
Yes, indeed. And if you have feedback or ideas for other episodes, be sure to give us a shout out on social media. Until next time, for Roots, Race, and Culture, y'all, we are out.
Funding for Roots, Race, and Culture is provided in part by the Norman C. and Barbara L. Tanner Charitable Support Trust and by donations to PBS Utah from viewers like you. Thank you.